Coming up today, Raspberry Pi hits 10 million, Facebook censorship comes under fire, and some company you've never heard of announces some things in San Francisco. Life will never be the same again. You're listening to episode 284 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
Amelia Heathman.
Hi.
And Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
Now, Roland, we should briefly mention an exciting new-ish thing that we're doing at Wired, the Wired Audi Innovation Awards, which you've been helping to put together.
Yes. So we, for the first time, we are doing some innovation awards for the best of British companies in a whole range of categories, including AI, product design, science. And this is going to be happening. The awards are going to be given at the end of the year.
In November sometime, or is it December?
It's November.
It's November. And you've been working with some really great judges to pick a shortlist?
Yes. So basically, there are seven categories. We asked a whole bunch of really impressive people in each field to suggest people who might win these awards. And they all suggested DeepMind and other people.
DeepMind have had a pretty good year. So you can find out lots more about the awards at wired.co.uk, and there's also some details in the latest issue of Wired magazine. Yes, Roland?
And there is a moonshot category. This is for the best British moonshot, and you can vote for that. So please do.
Okay, we will. All right, a thing you've learnt this week, Matt Reynolds.
So I learn what it takes for a container to be officially bear-proof.
Okay.
So this is something that's certified. You know, who certifies bear-proof containers? Obviously, it's the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee.
Love those guys.
I know, exactly. And to be certified, it has to pass a live grizzly bear test. So this means it's put in an area with a real grizzly bear, and if the container survives a total 60 minutes of bear contact time, that could be licking, biting, pounding, chewing, crushing, rolling, and it doesn't suffer a gap of over a quarter of an inch, then it's grizzly bear proof.
You know when you meet people, maybe at a party or something, and you ask them what they do, perhaps, and if they were to say that they are the people that this is their job, that they have to judge how safe containers are for grizzly bears. Like, how do you get into that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I thought for a second you were going to say this is their job and you're like a party with grizzly bears. It's only the bears themselves that do the testing. But
So it's not someone dressed up in a bear suit.
No, exactly. It has to be. And they make it very clear that it's only grizzly bear proof. So they don't test it with black bears or all those other kind of breeds of bears you get
pandas
in North America.
Yeah,
with
pandas. No, sorry. Well, you do. But
large, hairy gay men.
Well, that's a controversial thing to say. All right. Amelia, what did you learn this week?
Well, keeping with the bear route, we had some good news for the giant pandas. After 26 years of conservation work, they are now no longer endangered. They have been upgraded to vulnerable instead.
But there's still not a lot of them.
Yeah, there's 2,060 giant pandas in the wild, which is enough for them to not be endangered anymore. But obviously, I think this has been a bit controversial. Some people aren't happy with this because they think the removal of the endangered tag means that people aren't going to concentrate enough on keeping them going.
Yeah, I think the message was this doesn't mean that the fight to try and stop them from going extinct is over.
Exactly.
I found out a Pew Research study in the US recently found that 44% of adults now get their news from Facebook, a fact that will become extra relevant a little later on. Roland, you've got a very long fact.
Yes, I learned which songs get the most Shazams. So a while back, Shazam gave me access to all their data. And using that, we tracked the most Shazammed songs in the first 3 months of 2016, and we released the results this week.
Okay, so do you want us to guess what they are?
You can try. I don't think...
We won't be able to do it, will
no.
we?
No. Well, I mean, I hadn't heard of any of these songs, not even close. When they sent me them over, the only words I recognised were Justin Bieber. But okay. Would you like to have a go?
No, Justin Bieber. No, go on, there's five of them. Read them out.
Okay, so number one, 21 Pilots, Stressed Out.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, Alan Walker, Faded.
Yes.
This is
like the charts, but really, backwards. Go on.
It really is. Three, in at three, Justin Bieber with Love Yourself. Four is Amelia's favourite song, Lucas Graham, 7 Years.
Yes.
And, oh God, I'm not even sure I can pronounce this. So, 5, G-Eazy featuring Bebe Rexha, Me, Myself, and I.
Okay,
this,
so
wow,
we have,
that was humiliating on every level.
We have no idea what these songs are, so what's interesting about this?
So the interesting thing about tracking Shazams, aside from just seeing which ones get the most Shazams, is that, say, compared to tracking something on Spotify, you just get the total. With Shazams, you can actually see the moment when someone is interested in a song. So what we did is we broke down the song second by second, and we were able to see exactly that moment when someone thinks, oh, I really wonder what that is.
And that moment was?
Well, so it turns out that moment is the chorus at the beginning.
Which is kind of predictable, but still, it's good to know.
Yes, and now that obvious, well-known fact is confirmed by data.
And that's what our jobs is. Yeah, that's what our jobs are all about.
Exactly.
Kind of,
exactly.
All right, Matt Reynolds, we mentioned Raspberry Pi has had a landmark week. 10 million have now been sold.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, 10 million is a lot of tiny, tiny computers. So that's right. And if you don't know who Raspberry Pi are or what a Raspberry Pi is, it's that tiny kind of credit card sized computer. You know, their flagship model is about £25, I think, but they sell a Raspberry Pi Zero that's £4. Basically, they're for kind of makers and tinkerers or school kids or industrial people to put their own modifiable computers together. So what's really exciting is this week they sold their 10th million Raspberry Pi, which makes them the best-selling British computer ever, very comfortably.
Take that, Alan Sugar.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's been some other news for this as well. The Raspberry Pi Starter Kit, the official one, has gone on sale. And you had to play around with it.
Yeah, so it's going to go on sale in a couple of weeks. It's going to be available online for the usual Raspberry Pi retailers. It's really cool. So basically, you know, the thing is, if you buy Raspberry Pi, you get the board and, you know, it's got all, you know, ports and stuff, but what do you do with a kind of computer chip? What this starter kit has, it has a USB keyboard, it has a mouse, it has a HDMI cable to connect to a screen, has the SD card that has the operating system on, you can kind of boot it up. So it's got everything you actually need, so you can get that under the Christmas tree, whatever, for your birthday, and actually start coding on that day. So, you know, it's super easy. We set up in the wired office, and it probably took me, and I'm not good at these things, it took me about 2 minutes to go from, you know, unboxing to starting coding.
And it also comes with Adventures in Raspberry Pi, which is a book of projects, and you put together some projects for people that are getting started to play around with their Raspberry Pis and actually get it to do something, because
it's all
very well selling 10 million of them, but what are people actually doing with them? And this is a really good way to get started, to have some projects that have already been laid out for you.
Yeah, and we've got some kind of exciting, I think they're probably slightly ambitious projects to show you what the Pi is capable of. So we've got a retro arcade machine, so it can play, you know, Pac-Man or, you know, all those type of games. And a really cool one is a candy pie dispenser. So whenever you get tweeted, it basically is just like a Coke bottle, you know, on a Tupperware. Every time you get tweeted, it'll release a sweet, which I think is really
so
awesome.
That little dopamine hit that you get when you see someone faving or retweeting or atting you on Twitter is now actually made physical.
Yeah, with like a sugar high. It's a terrible, brilliant idea.
Yeah, especially if you are former podcast star Emily Reynolds, who lives in Twitter.
Yeah, just that lives off all the time, just endless flow of sweets.
Yes. Okay, so from that to a little bit of a pace change. We mentioned at the top of the show that 44% of American adults now get their news from Facebook, according to Pew Research. Do you use it as a source of news? Is it your way of getting the your kind of morning fix?
I guess it's kind of two questions. I would say I get news from it, yes. Is it the source of news that I go to? No, definitely not. I'm not like, what's going on in the world? I'll check on Facebook. However, I am like, I'll check on Facebook for, you know, a whole host of other things, and I will pretty much always see some kind of news article. So, yeah, I get a lot of news from there. I'm not looking for it, though.
Amelia?
I always see Twitter as my first thing that I go on in the morning. But in terms of Facebook, similar to Matt, I will just see it on there anyway. But I do not like that they got rid of the Facebook trending in the corner where they used to tell you what was trending, the reason why someone's name was trending. They've actually removed that now, so you have to physically click on it, which I find annoying.
And we'll get to some more details on that a little later. Roland, kind of the same?
Well, actually not, because I think that maybe I'm the last person in the entire universe who's not on Facebook.
Oh.
I know.
Wow.
Yes, never have been, actually.
Well, there we go. Moving on. And I guess I'm kind of similar. I haven't added any news organizations on Facebook. I don't follow them. But when people that I'm friends with post stuff, I tend to trust their opinion if they're friends with me on Facebook, because I know them in real life. And maybe I'll want to read things that they post. Which brings us on to a story that's been happening over the last couple of days. So Facebook has censored a Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph from the Vietnam War because it displays fully nude genitalia. The post, which was made by Norway's Aftenposten, which is the best-selling newspaper in Norway, fell foul of Facebook's moderators, who said that essentially new children are not allowed on Facebook. And it's difficult to describe the image, but it's that very, very famous image of a nine-year-old girl running from a napalm attack in the Vietnam War that is widely credited with changing the course of that conflict. It's a huge, huge image, very famous.
And which, when it was featured on the front cover of a US newspaper. I think it was the Daily Post, is that right?
Yeah, and the New York Times. So it was taken on June the 8th, 1972. A day afterwards, it appeared on the front page of the New York Times, slightly edited to crop out some cameramen that were running along the side of the road. And at the time, editors on the New York Times were torn as to whether to feature the image because it did have a girl, a very young girl, who was completely naked. And the New York Daily News also ran it. 44 years later, Facebook has made a different editorial decision. And that's proven to be really, really controversial. Before we get into the details of this, is anyone here offended by an image of a nine-year-old girl in this context?
In this context, no, because I remember doing the Vietnam War and during history for my A-levels, and I remember that photo being, it is iconic. It showed kind of how bad everything was, and really, like, it's very striking of her just with no clothes on, just running, and she looks like she's screaming as well.
Yeah, in fact, she's saying in the photo she revealed years later, it's too hot.
Yeah.
It's a heartbreaking image and a hugely important one. Facebook, in its defense, said that it's difficult to create a distinction between allowing a photograph of a new child in one instance and not others. That was a statement given to The Guardian.
I think this is important that Facebook, this was originally censored by an algorithm, correct?
I'm not sure, actually. I think I was reading in the Financial Times that it might be that an algorithm flags it up at the beginning, but the eventual decision is then made by a human, maybe. So in this case, it's kind of a little bit complicated. So Aftenpost wrote a story about very, very significant war photography, which it then posted on Facebook. The author of that story was then suspended by Facebook for 24 hours for posting, I think he put the story up four times with the image. And Facebook then got in touch with Aftenpost and said, okay, can you maybe pixelate the image or change the image or do something with the image so that it doesn't get pulled through, and then we'll stop censoring it? So there was this point at which a human being got involved, whether or not it was an algorithm in the first place. Facebook does use algorithms for censorship and to remove images that it reckons will probably be either illegal or offensive. So it's a really complicated one and quite an unusual one.
But the important thing is that Facebook is standing by this decision. It's actively defending the decision that's been taken, whether by the algorithm or it does seem like there's a human involved in it.
There definitely was. So the editor of the newspaper in Norway, Espen Egil Hansen, has written a front page open letter to Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, pleading him, as he describes him, the most powerful editor in the world, to essentially step up and take some responsibility for these decisions that are being made either by his subordinates or by the algorithms that his company relies on. So he said, "You're restricting my room for exercising my editorial responsibility. This is what you and your subordinates are doing in this case. I think you are abusing your power, and I find it hard to believe that you have thought it through."
I think that's a really good point, actually. What was it he said about calling Zuckerberg an editor?
The world's most powerful editor.
And I think it's interesting because it changes the way that we think about Facebook and how it acts, and actually what Facebook decides that we really should see or really shouldn't see really does influence what its 1.6 billion users see on a daily basis. So I think what's really important for this on a kind of more theoretical level is actually that we start acknowledging that actually the kind of content we get and the standards that we uphold Facebook to... you know, someone's making a decision here. We say, oh, journalists should cover this, journalists shouldn't cover this. But also we have to say, Facebook should let this go through. Facebook should give prominence to these things.
And let's take this back 44 years to the decision that was made by the New York Times and the New York Daily Post to run that image. 44 years ago, very, very different world, very different attitudes towards this kind of thing. And they both made the decision to run that image with a fully nude girl screaming, running down a road, and it changed the course of a war. Those decisions were made by, as journalists, we know this, there are people that we work with that have to make very, very tough calls on what should and shouldn't run, and they're trained, they've got experience in these kind of things, and it's their job, and it's not transparent, but it's kind of, it's upheld as journalistic integrity. When it disappears into Facebook, things get an awful lot more difficult. So to go back to Egil Hansen, the editor of the Norwegian newspaper, he says, you create the rules that don't distinguish between child pornography and famous war photographs. Then you practice these rules without allowing good space, a space for good judgment. Finally, you even sense a criticism against a decision, Finally, you even sense a criticism against and a discussion about the decision, and you punish the person who dares to voice criticism. Really, really strong words from someone who is obviously incredibly upset and worried about how Facebook are behaving this way. But is this just a case of journalists getting a bit overexcited?
No, I think we should all be worried.
Why?
Because Facebook's power is tremendous. And I think we all understand that there are so many things on there that it has to be done to a certain extent by algorithms, and algorithms aren't going to get anything right. But this seems like such a clear-cut case where you should be allowing this through. And they can't seem to see that, which is quite strange. So then they do appear to have shut down the page.
They removed the post profile, and exactly. They suspended the profile of the author of the original post because he kept on posting it.
Yeah.
And what we've had since is, I think, very prominent political figures in Norway have kind of taken it upon themselves to, oh, well, kind of a bit like I'm Spartacus. They're also posting the image. We posted a version of the image. The Guardian has posted a version of the image, Financial Times. So is Facebook going to keep on removing these images because they contain that image of a 9-year-old girl screaming, running down a road, having been covered in napalm during the Vietnam War? Is that going to happen? And it starts to become quite difficult for Facebook to make that about turn. And it seems like we're coming to a bit of a head with this issue, that it's been one that's been going on for a couple of years. And every time something happens around Facebook and censorship and editorial policy, that Facebook makes even bigger mistakes.
And I think in a way that what makes this very, very difficult is that Mark Zuckerberg says, we're not a media company, we're a tech company. And I feel like he needs to, as the head of this really important company, admit that he is having a really important role in these decisions. And if he can't even see that, then that is quite, I find that quite worrying, actually. And,
yeah.
And because also, I mean, is that this is such a clear-cut case. This is a very famous image that was published on the front page of the New York Times. What happened if there was a new war today and someone took an equally important image and then it never, ever got seen because of the Facebook algorithm? I mean,
yeah, and because of Facebook's community guidelines on which the algorithm relies and on which Facebook's human moderators also rely. So to go back to this algorithm idea, so in May 2016, Gizmodo reported that Facebook's trending news feature, which Amelia mentioned a little earlier, was intentionally suppressing right-wing news organizations, even though they were trending on Facebook. So Facebook was making the editorial decision to skew trending topics left rather than to let the full right-wing insanity of, as you might want to call it, of Facebook users be unleashed. So following the revelation, the social network decided to fire the team of editors who managed the trending topics and replace them with an algorithm. Within 2 days of being put to work, the algorithm had promoted a fake story about Fox News host Megyn Kelly and linked to a man in McDonald's masturbating with a chicken sandwich. Facebook said its decision to use an algorithm would allow it to operate at greater scale and to bring trending topics to more users. So there we go. Yeah, it's very, very complicated. And there have been lots and lots of other examples of this. I'll just rattle through a couple. In May 2016, Facebook's advertising censors banned a photo of a plus-size model wearing a bikini because they said it depicted body parts in an undesirable manner. It then defended its decision and then decided that actually it didn't and it was going to allow it. Anyway, in March 2016, Facebook censored a photo of a topless Aboriginal woman in ceremonial paint as it violated community standards. Facebook lets through a similar image of Kim Kardashian covered in paint, completely naked, lying in the desert, which was covered in Esquire. Facebook's editorial policy has also drawn criticism for what it refuses to remove. In June 2015, the social network said a video of a screaming baby being repeatedly dunked into a bucket of water did not breach its content policies and, in fact, raised awareness of child abuse issues, a position that the NSPCC said was mad. So, there's that. What do you think? Amelia and Matt, you've both been quite quiet.
I would say on this, I think what we have to think about are, what are Facebook's priorities as an organization? They're about maximizing the time that people spend on their platforms. They're about people sharing viral content so they get on it. And I think that we have to realize that probably Facebook's priorities don't really align with the priorities of media organizations or the maybe moral values of people in everyday. So I think that we have the expectation that Facebook upholds itself to editorial standards, like letting an important war image through, you know, and letting people display that. I think Facebook doesn't see that as a priority because it's not their priority. They don't see themselves as a media organization, like Roland said. And I think really, it doesn't surprise me, but I think kind of what Roland said, I think Facebook really needs to rethink its role, but I don't really think it will, because its priorities aren't in getting good content through. Its priorities are in clicks and time spent. And I, you know, where's the incentive for them to make better editorial decisions?
So Emilio, what do you think Facebook should do next? What should its next move be? Because it doesn't seem like this is the kind of story that's just going to end here. It's still developing as we're standing in this room speaking.
I think in terms of the Warford photograph, I think they should almost just give up the fight and just let it through. But they definitely should learn from this and think about, you know, what things are they going to let through? How are they going to control the content that's on there? I think firing the editors seems like quite extreme. It's unfair for them to lose their jobs. And what does that mean then for the future? Would it mean that, you know, all journalists and all editors will just be replaced by an algorithm, which will just incorporate news that people are just randomly posting on the internet? Like, what is that then going to mean for the future, and where is that going to go? That's quite scary.
Yeah, there's some really, really big issues here that we can't get into in a half hour or so podcast. So we'll move on to our next story. And Amelia, it's you again. Team GB getting ready for the Paralympics, which have just started in Rio. I think Team GB have already won 11 medals on day one, which is absolutely fantastic. But you've been looking at how they're working with technology and engineering companies to go even further, train even harder, and really, really optimize their bodies. And this is fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it was really interesting, actually. So I spoke to Thomas Naper, who's a graduate engineer at BAE Systems. And since 2008, BAE and UK Sport have had a partnership using the company's engineering technology to help Team BG be super prepared and change the way they're training so that they can push themselves further and further.
Mm-hmm. And this is, it's Paralympians and Olympians. But let's focus on what they've been doing with the Paralympics, because this is
relevant.
Really relevant and really, really clever, and something that I just hadn't even considered.
Yeah, it was. This is really interesting. So as part of this partnership, BAE created the first computerized indoor trainer for British wheelchair athletes. This is something Thomas said to me was, you know, when a British wheelchair athlete, they will specialize in track or they'll specialize in road. And obviously it would be really difficult for an athlete to go out and just train on the road, because obviously there's lots of cars around and things like that, and it's something I never thought about before. So this is one of the reasons why they've created this computerized trainer. Basically, it's a big frame that's combined with the turbo trainer to replicate different conditions. So coaches can put up resistance to mimic going around a corner, being on a track, being on a road, and with different kind of weather as well.
So it can simulate a variety of different conditions so that they could, say, replicate the road race track for the Paralympic Games, for the wheelchair marathon or whatever it may be, and create that in a room in Birmingham.
Yeah, or something like the London Marathon, which a lot of Shelley Wood, who I'm going to talk about in a bit, she she is in the Paralympics, but she's also won London Marathon in the past. So it's all kind of to do that and help their training in that way. So BAE Connect, this turbo trainer, this big frame up to a computer screen and a TV screen, so athletes can actually visualize what race they're doing while they're doing their training, so they can visualize like being on the road or being on the track in Rio, but they're not there, but it helps them prepare more in that way.
And the really exciting thing about this is the potential for virtual reality and other more immersive technologies to really, really make the athletes feel like they're on that course.
Yeah, and it's all to do with their preparation and them being able to visualize what they're going to be doing to make them feel more prepared and just feel ready to like take that race on. And so that is done, the VR technology is done using, so a coach will go to the track with a GoPro on their chest, film it, and then give it to BAE, who then turn it into a video. And an athlete can just download it on their phone watch it and visualize being in the race and get prepared.
Roland, you've spent an awful lot of time researching VR companies. This, to me, seems like a really, really great use of virtual reality technology. It's such a clever application.
Yes, exactly. And I think that if you're thinking about VR, all the hype about it being a mainstream technology, this that's not going to happen, I'd say, at least for a couple of years. But there will be so many more uses for this sort of thing. I guess, like you say, professional use and use in really interesting cases. I mean, in fact, I was meeting with a company the other day who are doing real estate, or as we call it, estate agent stuff with VR. So basically, you can look around flats, and so you would go to the estate agent, you'd put your headset on, and you'd look around 20 flats, and you wouldn't have to actually go to them. And that's exactly the sort of use that I think we'll see popping up everywhere in a kind of more of a business sense before it perhaps, if ever, goes mainstream.
But helping Paralympians is possibly more inspirational than real estate.
I really don't know what you mean.
Of course. So what else has BA been doing? Because this is quite a big project. So they're doing other things to help athletes prepare.
Yeah. So the other thing Thomas told me about is using wind tunnels to help the athletes find the most aerodynamic seating positions to race in. And this is really cool. So they put Shelley Woods, who I mentioned earlier, she's won 3 medals at the Paralympics and the 2012 London Marathon. They put her in this wind tunnel in Preston. And simply by telling her that if she moved her position a couple of degrees forward, she would then get an increase of speed by 20%.
Which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, it is. Because obviously you can train and train and train. You can push yourself as hard as you can, but it seems insane that something so small as changing the way you're sitting increases your speed and, you know, can push you onto that medal.
And they did this by analysing the way the athlete moves in the chair, and they push the wheels, and they redesigned the wheels as a result. So it was a lot of findings came out of doing this.
Yeah, big collaboration. So the wheel moment in particular, so they analyse the interaction between athletes' movements, the way they like push forward, they almost like punch their wheels. And so they created these stiff wheels, which meant that when the athletes move forward punching, the wheels wouldn't bend inwards, and this reduces the friction between the racers and the track, improving their speed and their acceleration. So they kind of almost reinvented the wheel. I think they like to pan it.
Very good, very good. So yeah, so when you're sitting on your sofa watching the Paralympics over the next couple of weeks, think about all the amazing technology that also makes it possible for these athletes to push themselves further and further. Really awesome stuff. Okay, so it kind of escaped your attention this week that Apple announced some things at an event somewhere on the west coast of America. Matt Reynolds, what did they announce? Very, very briefly, because most people probably know this already.
So, speaking of reinventing the wheel or not, so the headphone jack is gone from the iPhone 7 and the iPhone 7 Plus, as we all feared, I know.
Headphone jack gate.
It's happened. So those new phones won't be compatible with most wired headphones. Either you'll have to use wireless headphones or they'll connect via the Lightning port. Cleverly, surprisingly, Apple has thought about that and it's released AirPods, which are basically, they cost £159. They're basically a pair of wireless earbud headphones, 5-hour battery life, not very long. That, like I said, they're basically wireless versions of their existing headphones. Anyway, back to the phones. Both of them, that's the iPhone 7 and the iPhone 7 Plus, are now water and dust resistant. You probably can't swim with them, but they'll survive like splashes and rain and stuff like that. Storage capacity is doubled. They're now available in 32, 128, 256 gigabyte options. That's double the
so
previous
long,
generation.
So long, 64 gigabyte iPhone.
I know, goodbye. But also on the plus side, so long, 16 gigabyte iPhone. Yep. Big changes to the camera on the iPhone 7 Plus. It's now got two dual cameras, two 12 megapixel cameras. They've got wide and telephoto angle lenses. Both the front and rear cameras have also got some image stabilization upgrades. Last kind of product thing, the Apple Watch Series 2 has got an upgrade. It's super bright now. It's had a bit of a operating system overhaul, new processor, all that stuff. iOS 10 is with us. It'll be with us in a few days, September the 13th. And excitingly, Super Mario Run is coming to iPhone. So we've got Mario coming to iPhone.
And Android. Yep.
And Pokemon Go is coming to the Apple Watch.
Just in time for everyone to stop using it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Hooray.
Have you given up, Roland?
This is so sad, but I haven't. I feel deeply ashamed. Have you?
No, I'm playing it a lot less, but that's mainly because I've got quite a bit more going on than I did a couple of weeks ago. So,
hey, maybe Poke Hunt later?
Yeah. Let's go.
You're
let's
all
go
invited.
Battle some gyms? Jeans. Team Instinct, right?
The blue one? I can't remember.
Team Mystic.
Thanks. Forever. Resident Pokemon Go expert, Matt Reynolds there. Very good, quick summary of everything. The thing that got people most excited was the lack of a headphone jack. Are we excited? Are we angry?
No, we are very annoyed.
Are you annoyed?
I am. I just think that...
But you don't have to buy the phone, Amelia.
Well, I guess I don't, but I probably will.
There we go. And on the price thing, actually, this isn't in Matt's notes, but off the top of my head, I think Brexit has had a bit of a negative impact. The weakness of the pound against the dollar means that we're going to be paying about £100 more for Apple stuff over here. So I think the headphones, the AirPods, are $140-something in the States, £159 here. Obviously, that doesn't quite translate down. The pound to dollar doesn't work like that. Not even at the moment. Your Apple products are going to be even more expensive than they were. So thanks to Brexit for that. There's been an awful lot of hot takes, an awful lot of opinions.
So let's
Roland,
add to them.
Roland, you're chomping at the bit.
Well, I don't know. It is hard to say anything about this that hasn't been said. And also, I sort of feel I'm not an iPhone user. So in a sense, I don't have... the real opinion of the person who's going to be using this every day. I mean, Amelia, you're an iPhone user. You say you're going to buy this. I mean, what do you think from that perspective?
I have used other phones, and I do actually just prefer Apple. I find it an easier system to use. I think the fact that now on iOS 10 you can delete stocks, which I'm really excited about, things like that, I think. And also because I have a Mac, you know, it's easier to have an iPhone because you can do everything across the same things. So it won't change me from getting one. But there are certain elements I am not happy about. You know, those new AirPods, I think, are just a bit ridiculous. I mean, how easy is it going to be to lose one? And I'm pretty sure there's going to be a story when they come out and someone's going to have swallowed one. And just things like...
What? How? Why?
Because Amelia
so
is planning
small.
To.
Yeah. No. Because you listen to things with your mouth?
No, someone is so going to... It's going to happen. I would actually put a bet on that happening. Like a week after the AirPods come out, someone's going to swallow one.
Cool. Well, I guess it will come back out. So Farhad Manju in the New York Times said that what was really missing from the new iPhone was cutting-edge design. So if we look back, when you have Steve Jobs standing on stage announcing the iPod and saying that this is going to hold 20,000 songs in your pocket. No, 2,000, wasn't it? Or 10. A lower number.
Yeah.
Yep. And then you had the iPhone. That was a huge transformative moment. The iWatch, the Apple Watch, slightly less so. There's this idea that Apple should be not reinventing the wheel, but at least coming up with a clever new wheel every time that it announces something. It didn't this time, and people are going, oh, well, butt your ideas up. Right? Or wrong?
I think Farhad Manju is an incredibly influential tech columnist, and the first line of his piece was, forget about the headphone jack. And he basically went on to say that he thought that Apple's design was falling behind, people weren't as excited about their products. I mean, he didn't quite go so far as to say that Apple's losing it, but he strongly implied it, and he's very influential, and lots of other influential people have... I mean, let's say, they're not saying that Apple is going to not be a huge company and not sell millions of products, but that it doesn't lead in innovation in the way that it used to.
Yep. I think what's interesting is the iPhone has kind of been quite similar in terms of the way that the hardware and the software play with each other. They've introduced things like the touchscreen is a bit more advanced, so you can have like long presses and it can do different things. But that's kind of, they're nice updates, but it's only essentially adding a right click button, which maybe isn't all that exciting. What the iPhone maybe needs, and what smartphones will need, and the big leap forward will be when they start using artificial intelligence more intelligently, and that becomes more of a central part of their product. So you'll end up with something that's this weird skeuomorphic graphic user interface based piece of hardware and software into something that's more like a black box, right? And that's just not quite here yet. So you can kind of see why Apple isn't doing it. And arguably Google has better technology to do that anyway.
Yeah, I think before we always kind of associated Apple with big jumps in user interfaces, big jumps in doing things. So, let's think about, the original innovative product, the iPod. It had that mechanical click wheel, cool, good way to interact. Then they did that touch click wheel, even better. But then bringing in the touchscreen was a massive change in how we kind of thought about phones, because they weren't just phones anymore. There was something, a mini computer you could interact with any element with. And then they basically introduced the app ecosystem. So again, it wasn't about the hardware that you created, but they'd created a whole platform where actually it was like, it's up to someone else to put an interesting thing on it. It's up to someone else to really enable this device. Now, what I think is that since those big innovations, we haven't really seen, we've seen incremental product tweaks, better cameras, you know, better screen, in the same way that all these features work. They filter down from really expensive cameras and they get packed into this smaller thing. We haven't seen Apple really, you know, replay the playbook. I'm not saying it's their responsibility to do that. We haven't seen anyone change smartphones. But I guess my question is, I wonder, Rodan, what you think about this is, have we reached the ceiling of smartphone improvements? Is it because it gets?
I think it's possible. So in tech, they like to talk about the S-curve. And there's a lot of people think that we're reaching the top of the S-curve.
Hang on, which way is the S lying? Is it on its side?
No, it's just a regular S. Basically, okay. What it's talking about how it's a little bit wonky. Basically, it's just talking about how you get initial kind of slow growth, and then suddenly growth really, really accelerates and goes really fast, and then you reach the top and things start to slow down.
Okay.
Oh. And there's an idea that that only probably really the people inside Apple know for sure that we're reaching the top of that. I think also this relates to the point that you made earlier, James, in that most people see that the next big wave of tech is going to come from machine learning and AI. And normally for machine learning and AI to work, you need three things. You need massive data, you need a very aggressive policy in terms of the way you use that data, and also you need conditions which the kind of people who want to work on those programs, normally computer scientists from big universities, can publish openly. And Apple doesn't have any of those three. Or rather, it does, but not in the same way as, say, Google and Facebook.
Or even Microsoft.
And this is not an existential threat to Apple. They're still going to be a really big company. But if that is the next big thing, and Apple does lag behind it, as some people suggest, then maybe there is a possibility that wasn't there before, that Apple is something like the next, might be more like the next IBM.
Which is no bad thing for one of the biggest technology companies in the world that's been going for decades.
Yes, and it's still a very important, influential company.
Yeah.
But if you're Apple, you don't want to be the next IBM.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, that's true. Or even the next Microsoft.
Exactly.
You want to keep being Apple.
Exactly. But I mean, of course, who knows, right? Apple does have this history of they put something in the device which seems kind of cool, like interesting, like fingerprint scanning. So they did that, and then next up they brought in Apple Pay. And then suddenly there's this whole payments ecosystem, which is really potentially quite transformative. And, I mean, as we all know, my obsession is VR. So those two cameras, that actually might enable VR with regular phones, which would be really important. And who knows, maybe that might be the next big jump, because I think we're all asking, what comes next?
Yeah, and I think taps into an interesting thing is that I think we look upon Apple as, you know, well, you lead the way, you march us into the next, you know, the next tech world. We're not really asking the same thing about, you know, Samsung or HTC. And I wonder if we're part of the hype machine, right? I wonder if Apple says certain things as a brand. I mean, I think they said, oh, you know, it took courage to leave the headphone jack.
Groan.
I know. Yeah, really courageous. And I think that. And then there you go. You have, you know, loads and loads of column inches debating, well, were they courageous? And I think that on one hand, we're just kind of legitimizing that debate because we repeat back the brand claims that Apple make and we believe them and give them credence in a way that we don't do to any other brand. And I wonder why. You know, why do we interrogate Apple so much when, you know, Samsung is quite comparable in a lot of ways? And I wonder, you know, are we to blame?
I think there's a couple of things there to me. Samsung, based in South Korea. Apple, based right in the heart of Silicon Valley. It's got a press that's a lot closer to it. It's not open, but it's way more open than Samsung. And there are all these big stories that the American and British media like to tell about Apple. It's this leading light in the English-speaking world, whereas Samsung is very different. Roland, you're pulling your face. You disagree. And you also have the thing where Apple is kind of like a church, right? And it does that preaching thing way better than any other technology company. So all technology companies are full of this sort of BS corporate speak. But when Apple says it, everyone kind of applauds. When other companies say it, you can kind of see the world sort of groaning and biting on their fists.
I think that was that kind of the show of Apple that was definitely shown on Thursday when they had James Corden doing the carpool karaoke to take Tim Cook to the event. That big showmanship that they do, I think, definitely is one of the reasons why, you know, we hold Apple up so much, because they put themselves up there. They create this big show and we just lap it up.
The moment that really summed that up for me is when Tim Cook opened it up and he came on stage. And yeah, this is a room full of tech journalists and, you know, clever people, independently minded people, we hope. And he said, you know, and the really great thing is we've got 89% customer satisfaction and the audience loved it. And you just think that it's just this complete cycle of well, Apple, you know, it doesn't matter whether they're doing the right or the wrong thing because they're just getting this feedback that what they say matters.
Roland, you keep pulling faces.
Well, so hang on, just to make sure I understand properly, are you saying that we shouldn't expect too much from Apple? It's you know, why do you make such a big fuss? They're just another company.
I would say that the thing that you need to look at is the share price, right? The stock price, the valuation of Apple.
I knew you were going to say this, James.
I love facts, Roland.
Give me some numbers.
James has been threatening just to read out the stock prices for the last 5 years.
Yeah, a bit like the classified results on the BBC football show.
Go on then.
Apple, 1 point, well, whatever. Anyway, they're the second most valuable company in the world, or the first most valuable. They kind of change places with Google fairly regularly, I think. But they're both right up there. This is a hugely, hugely valuable company. It's one that the market still has a huge amount of trust in. And you kind of have the reactionary nature of the internet. Everyone needs to have this big hot take on the news of the week. There's a lot of traffic to be made in it, an awful lot of ad impressions to be gained by being the hot take on Apple's announcement. And that they announce a new phone, it's a pretty nice phone. They announce a new watch, it's a pretty nice watch. There's the Nintendo stuff. People like Nintendo.
But I feel like that you... I don't know... I understand why you're seeking to downplay this and minimise it. But I think that... Remember, think back to the conversation we just had about Facebook. It is really, really important which ones of these big companies are kind of on the up and which are, in many ways, running the world. We live in their empires, and we used to live in the Microsoft empire, and now we don't. And Apple is so powerful that if it does show signs of waning, if it does become less important, that's not just a tech story. That is a world story, and so I think actually that this stuff deserves to be interrogated in this way and poured over. I mean, maybe not in quite the way it is.
And it will continue to be, because there's clicks, Roland. There are clicks.
I'll be happy. But I do think it's important. It's more than just like what is on your device. It's big stuff.
All right, I'm going to put an end to this. I'm going to put you all on the spot. Oh, no, Matt, go.
Well, yes. I was just going to say, on your point, James, I'm not sure if I do care so much about Apple's share price, because you think, who does Apple target? It targets wealthy people, you know, who are living well anyway. And where does that share price go? It goes into Apple's huge reserves of money. I think if we look at technology companies that really touch huge amounts of the world, like Google, like Facebook, they have big share prices too. But I think if you spread that share price and that paper valuation against their potential impact across the world, I see Google as so much more of a significant company. I think we care about Apple because it drives the world and it drives an elite sense as where we want to go. But is it the company that's poised to change the world? I really don't think it is, irrespective of its value.
It's damn good at making shiny things.
Oh yeah.
So we have those transformative moments where Steve Jobs stands on the stage and announces the next big thing. And Tim Cook hasn't really done it yet. So my question to you is, the next Apple event, what does he stand up and announce that makes everyone go, that makes Farhad Manjoo and all of the people that influence this kind of industry stand up and go, yeah, all right, you've done it again. What can they announce?
Flying car.
Well, actually, I mean, they are increasing. I mean, not flying cars, but they are increasingly getting into cars.
I mean, it could fly.
I've heard about the car thing. That's why I think it needs to be flying in order for it to be super big.
Yep. Okay, flying car.
Speaking of unfair expectations.
Yep.
Yeah. I think flying, whatever. I'm going to accept nothing less than a car that can turn invisible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It also needs to be completely green. Otherwise, environment bad, Apple bad.
I don't think Apple would ever do an invisible product, just saying.
There you go. Zing. Matt?
A little bit longer battery life. 36 hours battery life.
That's what I was going to say. So he stands up on the stage and goes, this iPhone, the battery lasts for a month.
Bam.
Bam. Done. And it does. That's a true fact.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't mean anything to me, but that would be actually pretty impressive. I mean, as you know, I would like it if they stood up next time and said, We're launching a VR device and it is going to be incredible, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Roland wants to live in his virtual world.
I think James is going to be holding up a Nokia 3310.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, this smartphone has a month-long battery life and isn't pants.
Okay, yeah, that's the dream.
It's less catchy. Yeah. All right, what do you think out there, the listeners, if you can even muster the effort to have a thought on this thing. You can let us know. We're at WideUK or individually. Roland, you are?
At Roald Manthorpe.
Amelia on Twitter, you are?
At AmeliaX1.
I'm at MattSReynolds1.
And I am at J Temperton.
I miss Emily. With this always this moment when she had to go at Ray Z.
Yep. Yeah, well, you can still find her on Twitter, and she'll be delighted that you mentioned her on the podcast.
Oh,
yeah.
I know.
There we go.
Can we edit that out later?
Yeah, we absolutely can.
Please
we
do.
Won't. All right, thanks very much. We will see you again next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.